start a new recording, because we're going to start, at least for our last 15 minutes, to talk about our third topic, which is divorce. So I bring you, on your sheet, source number 14, which is from the Family Law Act of Ontario. A party to an application under Section 7, net family property, or Section 10, questions of title between spouses, or support, or powers of the court, or variation. I don't actually know what variation is. You know? Okay.
Variation is an application to change a previous order.
To change a previous order. Thank you. So, a party to an application under any of these headings may serve on the other party and file with the court a statement verified by oath or statutory declaration indicating that the author of the statement has removed all barriers that are within his or her control and that would prevent the other spouse's remarriage within that spouse's faith. So I've done everything to enable my spouse to remarry, and the other party has not done so despite a request. You follow what's going on?
I'm talking about the get.
That is exactly what we are talking about. This is this is Ontario's get law. Within 10 days after service of the statement or within such longer period as the court allows, the party served with a statement under subsection 4, in other words, the party who is allegedly withholding the ability for the spouse to remarry, shall serve on the other party and file with the court a statement, verified by oath, etc., indicating that the author of the statement has removed all barriers that are within his or her control and that will prevent the other spouse's remarriage within that spouse's faith. So in other words, to give the standard way in which this plays out, the husband is refusing the divorce. The wife goes to the court and says, I have removed all obstructions. My husband has not. The husband then has 10 days to respond and say, I took care of it. When a party fails to comply with subsection 5, then if the party is an applicant, the proceeding may be dismissed. If the party is a respondent, the defense may be struck out. So in other words, if the man is the one withholding the divorce, and after the 10 days he continues to withhold the divorce, then if he is applying for something in terms of property, title between spouses, support, powers of the court, variation of any of these things, whatever it is, his application may be dismissed by the judge. In other words, he doesn't have the right to file a claim. In the event that he's trying to respond to a claim, she says, I want $1 million a month as support, and he's trying to respond to that, his defense may be struck out. And therefore, he will be obligated to pay whatever it is that she has asked for.
So it behooves him not to get the get right away.
No, it behooves him to give the get right away.
It behooves him to give the get, but many women may rush right away and get the get in fear that the spouse won't give it to them.
Correct.
It could help her to not settle the divorce, not force him to give her a get.
If she doesn't care about getting remarried, then this may end up being to her advantage.
Or she can get whatever financial accommodation she wants from him.
Theoretically.
I'm not sure if that's entirely correct.
Yes.
The question is, at what point will a court say, we will not give you something you're not entitled to, despite the fact that the husband's fee has been thrown out?
Right. And it will depend on how the court looks at his refusal to participate in the get.
Yes.
That will, you know, if the judge is angry at the husband, he's going to be in trouble.
But I don't think there's any judge in today's family courts
right.
who would say, I'm going to give you $1 million
right.
For support.
Understood. So the question is, why is this necessary? Why did we need a get law?
Because they were being held for ransom, correct?
Correct.
They're being held for ransom.
For which we need to discuss the question of how divorce happens within Jewish law, which requires that we discuss first what happens when marriage breaks down within Judaism. So we start by going back to our two basic principles. Yeah?
I think that it's very interesting, when this provision was introduced, because like the consideration of Sharia law, the legal community was divided, as was created in Jewish Congress, about whether or not we wanted government intervention in religious proceedings.
Correct.
So there was quite a lot of division and discussion. Ultimately, of course, it ended up in this provision. But it is to be wary when we ask government to intervene
Oh, very much so. And it's a very important point. This came up at the time when they outlawed religious tribunals from handling family law cases. In other words, prior to this, so she would have pursued this in a Beit Din, and a Beit Din would have tried to compel him to issue the divorce in whatever way the Beit Din can, and we have to talk about that. But the downside of the court saying that we're now going to outlaw religious involvement is that now there's no mechanism whatsoever. And we're going to talk about prenuptial agreements, and the prenuptial agreement that's used in the United States has the couple, before they get married, sign a document saying that in the event that they're no longer living together, he is going to provide her with a get and this bill of divorce, and that if he fails to do so, he will pay her a certain sum of money, indexed to the consumer price index and so forth, per day, and that he will go to this rabbinical court to take care of the get, but that won't work.
That's
in Canada,
because we have all the women that have been waiting years for
it. It actually does work very well. The problem is you need them to do the prenup, meaning there is not a single case of aguna, the term for a woman who is waiting for a get, where there's been a prenuptial agreement. And there have been hundreds of cases where there was a prenuptial agreement and it led to a proper divorce.
And when did the prenup agreement start?
Prenuptial agreements have been in use in one form or another in the Orthodox community for at least 40 years. There's been a lot of debate over the years about the validity of one. We have to talk about, we're not going to get to it today, what's called a get meuseh, the problem of a forced get, and which ways are acceptable for convincing the husband to do this and which ways are not. We'll have to talk about people who ended up in jail over this. But the issue, the prenup debate and the question of what's valid, I remember that debate from when I was a little kid as an issue.
Unknown
yes.
Entity within the Orthodox community?
Yes.
I never heard of it.
Okay, yeah, it is quite known. The Rabbinical Council of America, which has 1,000-plus member rabbis, strongly recommends, without forcing, strongly recommends that the rabbis not officiate at a wedding unless there is a prenup.
I'm just wondering, a lot of the conservative marriage ceremonies now use the Lieberman Clause.
The Lieberman Clause.
And I know that it basically is supposed to protect a bride from a groom not being willing to give her a get, but my understanding is it is totally not enforceable.
So I don't know about the enforceability of the Lieberman Clause. What the Lieberman Clause essentially is the prenup I'm describing that goes on in the U.S., but incorporated into the ketubah instead of a standalone document. Orthodox communities are very loath to add clauses into the ketubah because there is a principle, going back to the Talmud, that states that conditional marriage is invalid. And they're concerned this would be viewed as a conditional marriage. You're marrying on condition that if this ever comes up, then they'll follow these procedures. So the Orthodox community says, you know what, let's separate them out. But Rabbi Lieberman was of the belief that you could include it into the in the ketubah. I don't know anything about its enforceability that I haven't looked into. Yeah.
This is a complete sidebar. But you say that the Orthodox community says conditional marriages are not valid.
Correct.
And I've been studying with another group, and the book that we're dealing with is called A Bride for One Night. And in the Talmud, Rav goes to another town and says, who will be...
But they don't actually marry, right? That the book mentioned that.
They do marry.
In the book, they might. But in the Talmud, where the story comes from, they don't marry.
They don't marry.
No, I'd be very curious to see the book.
Oh, yeah.
I mentioned this last week when we talked about polygamy, and I noted that you don't find a single case of polygamy in the Talmud. So I mentioned then that when Rav would travel from place to place to place, they would identify a woman who theoretically could become his wife, and that way it was meant to dispel any attraction he would feel to anybody, because he always has, so to speak, this option, but he never actually marries her. The man havaliyoma is the Aramaic term that's used when they would do this. But I wanted to get somewhere in terms of this topic, and I got distracted with the topics we're not ready for yet, which is the question of who gives the divorce and how it's structured and forced get, all of which is very interesting. But first, let's get back to basics. We talked about the imperatives for marriage being procreation and ethical growth, when you go back to the two versions in Bereshit and Genesis. Well, you find that that's where your first expressions of frustration with marriage show up in the Torah. Frustration of ethical growth is seen at the end of Parshat Bereshit. It doesn't take long. Right before the Mabul, right before the flood, when God says, I'm going to bring the flood, it's triggered by this. Source 15. And the powerful men, the Hebrew term there is B'nei HaElohim. So there are all sorts of midrashim which say that means sons of God, and it's angels and fallen angels and all sorts of fun stuff. But the literalists say, no, it means B'nei HaElohim is powerful men, because Elohim is used biblically to refer to judges and other people of power. So the powerful men saw the daughters of man, for they were good, and they took wives for themselves from all they chose. What does that mean? So various commentators on this, I was getting to the end of the sheet, so I didn't bring them. But various commentators on it, Rashi, Ben Ezra, Toldot Yitzchak, and others explain what they were doing was taking women by force, whether they were single, whether they were married women, did not matter. And the taking by force is the opposite of what we saw in Genesis chapter 2. The whole point we emphasized was that Adam and Eve start out as two souls in one body, and God says it's not good for them to be this way. I need to separate them and for them to find each other. Taking somebody by force is the opposite of that. You're frustrating Adam 2. You're frustrating chapter 2 of Genesis. That's one side of it. The other side of it is the frustration of Genesis chapter 1, of procreation. And here's the story, source number 16. This story gets ignored because it has the misfortune of being in Genesis chapter 4. So it's parked in between creation of the world, Cain killing Abel on one hand, and then right afterwards, the flood. So no one pays attention. It's right after he begat this one, and this one, and this one, and this one, and here you go. And Lemech is the great-great-grandson of Cain, of Cain. Lemech took two wives. One was named Ada, and the other was named Tzilah. Ada is a Hebrew/Aramaic term, which means pregnancy. Tzilah is a Hebrew term that means beauty. So you already see where this is going. And Ada birthed Yuval, father of dwellers of tents and cattle. His brother was Yuval, father of users of harps and pipes. And Tzilah also birthed Tuvalkayin, forger of copper and iron tools, and Tuvalkayin's sister was Naama. Lemech said to his wives, Ada and Tzilah, listen to my voice. Wives of Lemech, hear my statement. For I have killed a man with my wound and a youth with my bruise, for Cain will be avenged sevenfold and Lemech 77. If you actually understood that, you're way ahead of the game. What in the world happened? Bless you. What in the world happened within this story? So the way the commentators look at this is really to split off two different pieces. The first piece with Ada and Tzilah and their kids. And then the second piece, Lemech's statement 2, Ada and Tzilah. The latter half of it is explained largely in one of two ways. Either that Lemech accidentally killed two of his kids, Cain and Tuvalkayin, two of his kids, and now his wives want nothing to do with him. So what he says is, yes, it's true I killed them by accident, but after all, Cain got punished after 7 generations for killing his brother. I've got 77 generations, certainly, before I should be punished because I did this by accident. So that's one half in reading this. And it fits with the idea that he is the 7th generation after Cain, and now the punishment is coming to the family for Cain killing his brother. That's one read. The other read of this, traditionally, is that Lemech killed no one. His wives separated from him because they said, well, God said Lemech is going to be punished, Cain is going to be punished after 7 generations. The 7th generation is here. Why should we bother producing children? And they say, you know what, we've had enough. After they have these kids, they say, we're done. And that's what he is pleading with them for, saying, well, Cain may have done a bad thing, but have I killed anybody? I've done nothing wrong. If Cain gets 7 generations, I should get 77. It wouldn't be right for God to punish me for what my ancestor did. Neither of those is germane for our discussion of divorce. I've just brought it to explain the story. But the part that is germane is the first part of this. Ada and Tzilah. Because normally, at this stage in the Torah, you do not find women named. is just this one beget that one, and they're all males. Naama is mentioned, and it is assumed that the reason she is mentioned is because she is the wife of Noah. That's why she gets named there. But why are you mentioning his wives, Ada and Sila? So commentators, Rashi principally among them, and I realize that I'm at the limit, but we could take two more minutes on time to do this. Rashi says, because this was the practice of the generation of the flood. They engaged in polygamy, but not the original polygamy meant to maximize number of children. He had a wife who was for pregnancy, and that was Ada. And he had a wife who was supposed to stay young, fresh, and beautiful, not have to deal with pregnancy and nursing and bearing children and all of that. And that was Sila. And Rashi says this is the practice of the generation of the flood. This is part of their sin. Now you'll say to me, but Sila had kids. To which the answer is, because it didn't work, one of two things happened, right? Either she had the kids before they came across this arrangement, or because she decided she wanted to have children. But one way or another, this doesn't work for Lemech. Family planning didn't work out. But this split is frowned on later on in the Torah. If you're familiar with the story of Yehuda and Tamar, so Yehuda is married to a woman, and then he has they have a daughter. Well, all right, you know what? I shouldn't rush this. Rushing it is not wise. We're going to come back to this at the start, God willing, next week. So next week we have to cram in our discussion of divorce as well as LGBT, because I don't have the option of adding a week, because the week after that is going to be Shavuot. So we're going to have to figure this out somehow next week to get to discuss all of these issues. So come back next week. Thank you very much.